I mean, you got a 12 or 14 year old kid taking a completely wild animal, and in 90 days, they're leading around, petting it, laying on it.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that's
it's
crazy.
It's incredible. I mean, what the work they can do. You know, it just kind of does educate the other youth and members of the public saying, wow, that it is doable.
Hello, and welcome to You Know the Place, the show that explores all the shops, clubs, pubs, and grubs you always pass by but never seem to visit. I'm Lacey Daly.
And I'm Joel Wayne.
Hey!
Hi.
How's it going?
Good. It's a hot one out there, and unfortunately, I have kind of a hot field trip planned. You ready? We are going to the Boise Wild Horse Corrals.
I'm giving you eyebrows,
you
but
are.
You can't hear those.
You're giving me a look. So we had a colleague who was heading out for a story, to shoot guns with someone for a story on BLM land, and he saw signs for these wild horse corrals, and he told us about it, and that sounded intriguing. So looked it up. It is it's a BLM, a Bureau of Land Management program. There's very little info about it. Now, I have coordinated with them, with a contact over there, with a representative
over
there.
Yeah, okay. Because I was like, do they just always have wild horses?
Right, yeah. And again, you know, if you go to their site, it's hard to tell. That it says, you know, in terms of hours of operation, because I'm just trying to get, like, info about it. No regular hours available. When horses are available, you can schedule an opportunity to view or adopt them by calling the Boise District Wild Horse Specialist.
Okay, so did you confirm there are horses for us to meet today?
Yes.
Okay.
And so we're meeting a couple people out there, and they're going to give us, you know, kind of a quick tour of the facility, and there should be horses out there.
Okay, so then let's start with your central concern. Where are you at?
My central concern really is twofold. Where are these horses coming from? These are wild horses.
Okay, that was my question.
Yeah. So where are they coming from? And then part two, kind of where do the people come from? Who are the people who are coming to adopt these, you know, these wild horses? And then I guess the second part of that is what are they doing
with
wild horses?
Yeah. Wild horses are drastically different behaviorally than domesticated horses, right? And
like feral cats.
Yeah, but times a million in terms of brute strength and muscle.
Right, right. They don't scratch you, they'll bite you.
Yeah. So needless to say, you're going to be barebacking today, right?
I don't know what that. And it felt kind of an inappropriate thing to ask. It was like we need to reach out to HR or something about that question. I don't know. I don't really know. I don't know if we're going to be I think we're going to see horses. I don't know how close we're going to get to them, and I don't know what the safety is there either, you know.
When's the last time you rode a horse?
I rode a horse maybe about 10 years ago, and that was like the first one I'd ridden since I was a kid, so
I had the opportunity to ride through the backcountry of Yosemite on horseback.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had no idea what I was doing. I was very out of place.
Yeah.
But it was super majestic. I'd totally do it again.
I bet so.
But not on these horses, not out in the hot desert. So curious to see what comes out of today.
Right. Yeah. It should be interesting. Again, it's gonna be a warm one. You want to go meet some horses, take a break and meet some horses?
Yeah, I'm down.
All right.
Oh, God.
LD, do you know what's going on with the removal of the Karcher overpass between Nampa and Caldwell?
Yeah, the Idaho Transportation Department is replacing the overpass to allow additional lanes to be built on I-84.
So that's like common knowledge?
Yep.
Where are you reading this from?
I'm not reading anything. I just learned it from ITD's new podcast, Drive Idaho.
I did not know that existed.
Yeah, no kidding. Drive Idaho is a podcast devoted to providing news and information about road projects right here in the Treasure Valley.
So where do I find this podcast?
Oh, you know, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, I'm subscribing right now.
It's about time.
Okay, so we are apparently pulling up.
Yeah.
This looks like the right place.
Yeah, it does. And there's definitely horses and corrals. Yeah, let's pull in.
I'm not pulling into a corral.
Joel is actually pulling us right into a pen, and there are horses
into a paddock
staring us down.
So yeah, we're in the middle. I mean, honestly, it's mostly gravel pits and quarries out here. It's heading out towards the prison. Nothing except, you know, the Owyhees in the smoky distance, and then just you know, it looks like a half a mile of cyclone fence, of barbed wire and cyclone fence. So.
I have no idea what he just said. we're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and we should have worn our cowboy hats and boots.
Yeah.
But you know what? Your Patagonia shorts will do.
Okay. All right.
Should
well,
we go check it out?
Yeah, let's check it out.
All right.
We meet up with Mike, a local BLM public affairs specialist, Raul, who runs the day-to-day operations out of the Boise facility, Heather, another public affairs officer based out of Twin Falls, and Chris, a wild horse and burro specialist from the state office who knows more about the national program. We do the introductions, put on another layer of sunscreen, and then start the corral tour. Heather kicks things off with a brief history of the Wild Horse Program.
So if we were to take a look at the history of the Boise Wild Horse Corrals, they were actually built in the late 70s, and they were designed to hold the horses that we had gathered from any one of Idaho's six herd management areas. And those are the areas where wild horses roam on public lands here in Idaho. So they were built never with the intention of holding horses year-round, but in 2009, due to limited space nationally, we then essentially got the privilege of having horses here year-round.
We confess that we're not really up to speed on the whole process, so Heather backs things up a bit for us and explains why they gather wild horses in the first place.
Wild horses received federal protection in 1971 with the passage of the Wild and Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act, and Congress essentially said, hey BLM, hey Forest Service, those wild horses and burros that are found roaming on public rangelands, you're responsible to manage them in balance with other uses, but essentially healthy horses and burros on healthy rangelands.
Uh-huh.
Because wild horse herds really don't have any natural predators, a population or herd can double in size every 4 years.
Uh-huh.
So they essentially eat themselves out of house and home, and that's where BLM has to come in, and we gather those excess animals. We will always manage healthy herds, we hope, on healthy rangeland. So it's our mission to always have horses out there, but they just have to be the right number of horses. So that's what started. So then what do you do with all these excess animals? Well, we care for them off the range, either in a facility like this or in off-range pastures. And then we offer them for adoption.
Mm-hmm.
The Bureau of Land Management will actually hold on to the actual ownership, essentially, or title to that horse for 1 year. And then we'll go out and we'll check. We'll make sure that that horse is receiving kind of care that it needs prior to giving title
like
to that animal.
Horse social work.
I know. I was like, this is kind of like CPS, but then like a vehicle title or title to your house.
We head out to walk along the corrals and look at the horses, which are divided up by age and sex. There's about a dozen corrals, about half of which contain horses.
So this is, you know, these horses here were actually the last few horses that came off the soda fire. If you guys recall the soda fire in Owyhee County, devastating fire, almost 300,000 acres. These horses were stud horses. They were slated to go back to the soda fire. We ended up with a few extra stud horses. We returned everything we needed to return to the soda fire. We had a few leftovers, they stayed here. We gilded these horses. They were studs till up to about 2 months ago.
Oh, wow.
And they were gilded then. Now they're available for adoption to the public. These horses here, you know, you gotta treat them as if they're a wild animal. They're not exposed to people. They're not exposed to the public outside of them getting fed and us walking around here, make sure they're watered and fed. They're not getting worked with. So anybody walks into one of these pens, their defense is run away from you.
Right.
And if they can't run away from you, put them in a corner, they're gonna run over the top of you.
You know, what we've found, we have a really great partnership with the Mustang Heritage Foundation. They've worked alongside BLM for a lot of years to help us increase our placement of wild horses into private care. And we really have found that our adopters tend to be more successful if there is some kind of a basic foundation of handling. You can go out there and you can put a halter on that horse, you can lead that horse, you can pick up its feet, mm-hmm. which only leads to you know, them being able to provide the appropriate care, the veterinarian care, the farrier care that that horse is going to require. And so back to Mustang Heritage Foundation, they actually had this brainstorm in 2007. I think the director at the time was watching Extreme Makeover Home Edition. And she's like, hey, why can't we do this with horses? What if we took 100 wild horses, 100 trainers, 100 days? Let's see what happens. And that, out of that was born the Extreme Mustang Makeover. And it's been a really great competition. Those horses were then offered for adoption.
Yeah.
Following the competition, and it's been great.
So, and it sounds like for a lot of people then, that's part of it, the adoption piece of it,
yep.
And being the one to do this, to work
their own work.
I think if you talk to any trainer, they all will say that first touch, that first time when they're able to get their hand on their horse is a magical experience. I think every trainer I've ever talked to, that's what they say first.
Next, Chris tells us a bit about the process when wild horses come in off the range.
So once we remove animals off the range, we need to vaccinate, deworm, we freeze brand on the neck so it has a special unique identifier so we can identify the horse. We have even been starting to microchip some horses.
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah,
was chipping.
We're starting to implement a microchipping program.
Yeah.
And the microchipping, it's not really going to serve as a tracking device out in the field or anything
like
that. Yeah. It doesn't have those capabilities. They're mainly up close.
I see.
But you could scan and get a history, I'm guessing, then? When they're in here, yeah.
When they're in here.
Chris tells us about the tall order the horse management and adoption program is faced with fulfilling.
Our population on the range is growing at a faster rate than we can adopt horses at the time. So.
Yeah.
And if we keep removing horses from
this
the range
that is
to maintain
to and,
rangeland health conditions, I'll be the first to admit it's expensive to hold these animals in an off-range corral like this or even an off-range pasture, which is a little less expensive because it's more hands-off.
Mm-hmm.
But the need, don't get me wrong, the need to remove those horses from the range is really high. But
sure. We
don't have the funding capability to remove and hold, and we don't have the adoption demand to be able to adopt enough out to where we can remove that many.
Right.
Back in the early 2000s, we were able to place about anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 horses a year. That plummeted around 2008 when the economy tanked. Mm. I think we only placed 2,200 horses that year. It was not good. The good news is we have been climbing up in our adoptions. Mm-hmm. Right now, as of fiscal year 2019, we're at over 4,200 horses. This is the first year that BLM has implemented what we're calling an adoption incentive program. So it's putting the focus onto our untrained animals. We'll now pay you, if you're a qualified adopter, so you meet all of the requirements, we'll pay you $1,000.
Oh.
And it's designed to help with that initial cost of horse care. You know, whether you want to pay a trainer to get that horse leading, loading, picking up its feet so you can handle it, or maybe you need to buy more panels so that your facility meets the requirements.
Sure.
So that's, and we've actually had well over 1,000 people that program was implemented in March, and nationally we've had over 1,000 people participate here out of the corrals. Raul, what'd you do? Place 18 this week or last week?
Yeah, last week.
Oh, okay, great.
I mean, he's kind of rocking it
here. Raul next tells us a bit about their partnership with the local 4-H clubs.
One of the biggest things I always tell people that about the 4-H program, you know, is the relationship that we're building with these kids. It's a great partnership, but the biggest objective and the biggest goal is what these young individuals are getting out of this journey. You know, they're taking these horses home for about 90 to 100 days, and then they come back to one of our facilities here and showcase their horse, make sure they're ready to go to the main event. Once they get to the main event, they get to showcase their horses there, at Western Idaho Fair here in a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We have 4-H coming to that, and they're going to be there we'll be there for 3 days. And on Sunday, they get to adopt their horse.
You know, since its inception 10 years ago, we've placed over 300 wild horses into private care. Over 500 4-H kids, age 12 to 18, have had this awesome opportunity to gain good horsemanship, unique horse handling skills. I think they've raised over $43,000 to support Idaho 4-H.
It really showcased what these horses are capable of. I mean, you got a 12 or 14-year-old kid taking a completely wild animal, and in 90 days, they're leading around, petting it, laying on it.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's incredible. I mean, what the work they can do. So, you know, it just kind of does educate the other youth and other, you know, members of the public saying, wow, that it is doable.
Yeah. I'm wondering if somebody's never had a horse,
is this not where they would come, or do you try to like direct them elsewhere, or how does that work?
They do. You know, that is the challenge. We do, I think our wild horse program does tend to attract a lot of folks that may not have that horse background or horse experience, but they are absolutely in love with the idea of having a wild horse. And I know Raul could tell you how much he would work with them to try to help them. We make a list of trainers that would be available to work with them and try to make that as successful as we can.
Like Heather mentioned, if you come here and you tell me, I'm completely green to this, I'm brand new, I've never dealt with a horse, but I want to work with a wild horse, I'm probably going to tell you everything about the horse you're getting, and I'm also going to list out trainers, people that can possibly help you. I'm going to encourage you to possibly go through the training incentive program. So by the time you do get your horse, a horse has been handled.
Yeah.
I'm going to probably encourage you to work with those, with that trainer.
I was going to ask, so do you play like matchmaker? How does that work?
You know how a lot of people, I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. If you're going to pick something, you're probably going to pick the pretty one.
Right.
I mean,
yeah. Right.
So a lot of people may come here and be like, man, I really want that gray one right there. And I could tell you, I don't know if that's the best one for you.
Doesn't matter.
I mean, that one is bouncing off the walls, but she's pretty. I really want her. Yeah. That's the one I want.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, I mean, that is the mentality, especially for folks that are new into it.
Yeah.
We all have that tendency. We're going to pick the pretty one.
Yep.
You know, and sometimes the pretty one might not be the right one for you.
Yeah.
We walk to the backside of the pens and get an up-close look at some of the mares, who are a bit more docile than some of their fellow equines. Heather tells us about how the wild horses physically are brought in off the range.
Who captures them? Are they using a lasso?
So these horses, if you can imagine, millions of acres, essentially, west-wide.
Yeah.
And what we've found over the years is that truly the most efficient, humane, and safest way to gather large numbers of horses is with the use of a helicopter. And when I'm talking about it, I usually like to talk about it as like, you can consider the helicopter to be sort of a border collie in the sky.
Okay.
He works to herd those horses toward what we call our trap. That's where we have kind of a funnel that we set up with soft-sided jute.
Mm.
It's the carpet backing, and that's forms the wings of the trap. We actually have what we call a Judas horse. Yep. So one of the wranglers will lead the Judas horse out to the mouth of that funnel.
Okay.
And as the pilot is bringing those horses in, I mean, it's a timing thing.
I bet.
So that wrangler's watching for that, essentially the lead horse to look at that Judas horse, and then he'll release the Judas horse, and they will follow him right into kind of a series of corrals that they have set up.
We get to pet some horses. LD falls in love and uses her pony voice.
Activity. You're beautiful. Okay, now I'll get a horse, okay?
Now you'll get a horse.
It was going to be a kitten, but now I'll just get a horse.
Oh, I love that. We can work with you.
We head inside. It's a long and large indoor corral, about the size of a small gymnasium with a tiny air-conditioned office on the side. We post up in here for a half second, just long enough to cool off our sweat-soaked shirts.
We try to minimize the amount of people we have in here. We reduce it down to the people we absolutely need to do our job.
Yeah.
We've noticed that we have excess individuals in here. The intensity just increases. The safety of the horses it goes out the window because they're really stressed, or people walking around, and it doesn't work. So we try to keep it to just the adequate amount of people in here.
What about the amount of horses then that you're bringing in at a time?
Two at a time.
That's it?
Sometimes none. If they're really fresh, they're just off the range, we might do just one at a time. We might just do bring one from the snake, what we call the snake, the sheeted alley, into the chute. We put them in this chute right here, what we call a sweet chute. What this box is meant to be is to secure the horse as safely as we can. And as you can see, the inside of it is all padded.
What are you doing to them in there?
So once we bring them in here, you know, they come in that direction. And it's all hydraulic driven.
Okay, just to give a little verbal picture of the squeeze chute, what we're looking at and hearing right here. It's a narrow metal box, about 8 feet high by 8 feet long by 2 feet wide. The horse enters in hydraulics control pads that slowly compress against the horse until they're immobilized. Then, opening little gates near their hooves, head, or body, a vet can work on them without endangering the horse or themselves. Also, the whole chute can rotate onto its side like a table, so a farrier can work on the horse's hooves. It's impressive, but I also understand why a horse would really not dig it.
So that's kind of, this is where all the work takes place.
Yeah.
Like I said, again, we're very fortunate to have a building. In the wintertime, this comes in very handy.
Oh, yeah. I bet.
We finish up in the facility and the corrals and head in to chat a little more in the main office, a narrow little manufactured building with cool air and soft seats.
Mike, you mentioned that there's controversy about the wild horse and wild horse adoption program.
There's not controversy surrounding adoptions. No. I mean, that is a full-on white hat. But our management on the range, there's a lot of passion about wild horses on the range, certainly. And there's disagreement about how they should be managed. What it boils down to, you know, BLM is a multiple-use agency. And we have to balance our management of wild horses with other uses on public rangelands.
Yeah.
Our job is to maintain that healthy balance. You know, so each wild horse and herd management area has been allocated for a certain amount of horses, a certain amount of livestock, other uses. Our job is to try to maintain that balance. And it's not as easy as it sounds.
Heather and Raul spell out some of the tools in their wild horse management toolbox that they're prevented from using or sometimes even researching the effects of.
We've got to get better at our fertility control measures. And we've got, I think, 11 or 17 different research projects that we have dedicated, I think, $21 million to. But it's also, like, I remember when you talked about, well, we spay and neuter dogs, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, spaying a mare is very controversial for some of our interest groups. Mm-hmm. And so some of our research projects, we get sued out the gate.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And so we're not able to really take a look at what that would mean. How would spaying a herd of mares affect them and their behavior on the range?
One of the other things that we don't, in my opinion, I'm not going to speak for everybody here, but in my opinion that we don't talk about is, yes, we don't get to use these tools, these management tools that we were allotted to use to try to maintain these healthy populations. But we don't talk enough about the repercussions of not using these tools, of what actually happens out on the range when a herd management area is allocated to have, for say, 1,000 head of horses and you have 10,000 head of horses.
Right.
There is a great chance that the resource that those horses depend on is no longer there because it was never meant to sustain that large number.
Sure. Right.
So those repercussions, I feel like, you know, we turn the blind eye to it because the problems are happening out there. The horses are starving. We're getting diseases. They're dying out in the range. That is no way to let an animal go.
Right.
So that is our job. Our job is to try to manage the consumer out there, which is either the livestock or the horse, to hopefully provide those healthy rangelands and provide these ecosystems to generations to come for your kids, my kids, vice versa, you know, however that may go. You know, when we're gone, they can still enjoy the same thing we're seeing here.
Heather sums up the BLM strategy and goals for wild horses in the near term.
And ultimately, that's where BLM is at. We're looking to increasing our adoptions and getting better at our fertility control. And that is where we are at with in the purview of what we're
doing. Placing most of the resource, okay.
Right, yeah. And it is expensive. Yeah. It costs about $50 million to feed and care for 50,000 animals off the range. We're, you know, doing what we can to look to more off-range pastures, which tend to be more cost-effective. Last year, nationally, we gathered about 11,000 horses from the range, which is helping. It's helping reduce that population a little bit. It's not quite anywhere near where we need to be.
Sure.
Last, Heather speaks just a bit about how much they appreciate the folks who come out and participate in the program and end up adopting a horse.
You know, that is one thing about our wild horses. They really do have a fan club.
Mm.
And that's special.
Yeah. I think all you gotta do is spend a little time around a horse and you're kinda like, it's like really magnetic.
I know, LD, you petted one today.
I know.
We're gonna work on your facility. Oh, yeah. And have you been thinking of a name for this one?
Here we go.
If we could convert you or somehow entice you to take one home, we would love it.
Yeah.
We thank the team for their time, and we head out to the car to debrief.
Thank you.
Can I say?
You can say, yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a big, big part of it was that it was just a group of really, really wonderful people who were passionate about what they're doing.
Isn't that what it always comes down to?
Yeah, I guess so.
And I also had a moment, you know, we're walking towards these horses, and you know, they're running away from us. And I was like, this would be the most frustrating job. You know, you're just trying to do good and these horses hate you. But then, like, even before we pet one kind of didn't run away from me. And I was like, I could do this for the rest of my life.
But, so you see the difference right there, right? You would get to see the change you would get to be a part of the change.
You totally see what draws people to this. I'm sure that everybody has moments like that that reminds you, it's like, this is a good thing.
Yeah.
But we'll unpack this later. Do you want to, like, go find a body of water to dunk ourselves in?
Yes, I do. I want to go get, like, an icy, like, the largest icy that we possibly can get.
And then maybe, like, go down to Quinn's Pond and do
Quinn's
a cannonball.
And then drive home naked.
Okay.
Okay.
Joel, what's one thing you think our listeners have in common?
They think we're funny.
Okay, less about us and more about the podcast here. All the places we visited are in...
Idaho.
Yes, so our listeners probably enjoy exploring and learning about Idaho?
Yeah, I'd take that bet.
So don't you think that they should check out the Idaho State Museum?
Totally. It has so many exhibits and all this information about this great state of ours.
We're talking over 500 artifacts, 46 multimedia displays, and nearly 900 photographs that all help tell the story of the people and landscapes of Idaho. Doesn't that sound like something our listeners would be into?
I think they'd really dig it.
Learn more about upcoming exhibits, museum hours, admission pricing, and special events at history.idaho.gov.
So here we are.
Let's unpack the Wild Horse Corral. Okay. What were your first thoughts?
Initial impression, honestly, was that there was so much information to take in. There were so many angles there. There's resource management, obviously, because that's kind of the BLM's main charter. There's animal welfare. There's cultural and social implications, financial concerns, and looking for effective and future-proof ways to manage herds that double in size. Every 4 years.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of information, and I knew next to none of it.
Yeah, me neither.
It goes to show, I thought, that these people that work there, and some of whom we had the opportunity to meet and chat with, they are super smart.
Yeah.
Because they could just pull these numbers and these percentages right off the top of their head, so you know that they know what they're doing.
They're intimately familiar.
And they're so passionate about what they do.
Yeah.
But I think in a job like that, you kind of have to be. Burnout would be so high because if you didn't care about it and this stuff got in your way, like there's so many other avenues where there could just be drama and stress other than just your day-to-day job, these outside factors where it's like, screw it, I'm going to go work at the post office.
Right, right. Another government job that maybe, you know, is less...
I just don't know if there's... it's so two-sided, the post office.
Yeah, yeah.
Central concern?
Central concern really was about, it goes back to what it is, I think, a lot of the different times, about who are the people who go out there, and then what are they doing with the horses that they adopt? And it's a mix of things. You know, we heard a bunch of different, you know, just riding, dressage, roping, you know, kind of rodeo stuff, trail riding, you know. And then it's also a mix of people.
You forgot cuddling. Cuddling the horses.
Just cuddling. Yeah. Spooning.
Yeah, spooning horses.
Big spoon or little spoon, depending on your size. And it's obviously a mix of people who adopt, although it does tend to skew towards people who have either have a history with horses or have continued to hold on to this dream, you know, kind of this abstract dream of owning.
The American West.
Yeah, owning a wild horse.
Yeah, but so. I was actually surprised how open these folks were to working with people who have no horse experience.
Like, I was
I'm
too.
Pretty sure Heather would send me home with a horse.
Mm-hmm. You'd be like, I guess I'll be putting it in a storage facility.
No, we clarified. I have a high enough fence for a baby.
Yes.
Yeah.
For a baby.
A baby horse.
I like how you keep referring to it that way.
Final thoughts?
Partnerships. Partnerships seem to be such a big component of their program at this point. Realizing that there are people who do have kind of similar goals and trying to work in tandem with them, whether it's 4-H, whether it's, you know, the fairs, FFA.
Mm-hmm.
So partnerships was a big, big thing that I felt like kept popping back up.
Oh, well, I feel like they have to. They have to be exploring every opportunity to get themselves and their horses out there just in terms of adopting them out and making room. I don't know how else. It just seems so overwhelming when I think about it.
Yeah.
You know, I was adding up all these little magical moments that I was having there where, like, I would make eye contact with the horse and it would blink and I would see its eyelashes and it all seemed worth it. And I think that that's something I would not have been able to understand had we not gone there.
Yeah. That's nice. It's attaching a face to the project or the program.
A snout.
Granted, yes, it's a horse face.
And I hung up my poster of a burro.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Nice.
I'm going to get one now. Do you think it could live in my shed?
Should we? Yeah. The burros, it's a different. Yeah. They can live in a shed. Should we end this this episode with, like, happy trails or something?
No.
Happy trails to you.
Good.
Okay.
I think we can use that.
All right.
You Know the Place is a podcast brought to you by Boise State Public Radio.
And if you like the podcast, consider supporting the podcast.
Absolutely. This really is a passion project for us, and we'd like to continue making episodes.
But there are no guarantees. So if you'd like us to make another season of the podcast, consider donating $20, $10, or even $5 to keep us in business.
Go visit youknowtheplacepodcast.com and click on the support link on our homepage to make a secure donation.
And I'll tell you what, if 100 of you donate, we'll set up a time to meet in downtown Boise to share a drink and hang out.
With 100 people? Also, tell your friends about the podcast. Rate and review it wherever you listen. Just help us get the word out there, team.
Anything else?
Our sole credit. Our music is James Dean Kindle and the Eastern Oregon Playboys, who's been a supporter since the very beginning.